So this is termed in Buddhist speak the four establishments of mindfulness. That term is a little confusing, or it has been for me. And so I finally realized what it meant was, these are the practices that you use to establish your observation. And you're to establish your observation in four areas, four grounds. The ground of your body, the ground of your feelings, the ground of your mind, and the ground of the objects of your mind. The ground of feelings. When we bring our alertness and awareness and remembering that the experience of our feelings is positive. These are feelings we like. Not positive. Feelings we'd rather not experience. Neutral. And mixed. So that our feelings show up in all these many ways. And they show up in all these many ways, moment by 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 moment. So the training here in terms of mindfulness is to be aware of the quality of the experience of your feeling. So that when you are feeling something unpleasant, you know it's you're able to say this is unpleasant. When you're feeling joy, you're able to acknowledge that this is joy. When it's sadness, you're able to acknowledge that this is sadness. For many people, anger, and Thich Nhat Hanh has a great book on anger, all of anger. We did a retreat in Korea because his book on anger was a bestseller. And Peggy and I got to go along, and we had several hundred people at a weekend. And one man came to me, a Korean gentleman, and said, I've been practicing with anger for 10 years, and I'm only a little better. And I said, at least you know. I come from a whole country of people who don't even know that they're angry, or how deep it is, or how destructive it is. You know, what we get taught, well, if you're angry, make up a dummy of someone you're angry at and then beat it. And that you can do that if you really want to train yourself to be angry and beat other people. But that's what you're training yourself to. You're training your mind. Everything we do, we train our minds. So the practice is to observe the arising of feeling. To begin to train yourself so you can tell when a feeling is started. And I've had this experience of discovering my feeling beginning. And I feel it, I realize it's beginning before it gets to my mouth. Before it gets to my hands. And the various gestures that can take form when that occurs. And so the practice is so that we are so in touch with our depth that we can feel our feelings emerge, arising like a wave. And it could be a little wave, it could be a medium-sized wave, it could be a really big wave. But we are aware this is emerging. Joy, the wave of joy is emerging. Sadness is emerging. Grief is emerging. Happiness is emerging. Anger is emerging. The practice is not to suppress our feelings. The practice is to be mindful of their occurrence. And to understand their origin, their path, and not to hold on to them. Because what we've learned is feelings come into being, feelings go out of being. There's a popular phrase that our nieces and nephews use with one of their kids. It's like, wait for it, wait. That's what we have to learn to do with our feelings. An old friend of mine, Robert Shropshire, was a school teacher in Boston. He and I had worked together, and Gene and I and others, and he's such a funny man. Anyway, one of the things he would say, when people would say, come to him and say they're thinking about getting married, he would say, well, you know, you should wait a couple of days and make sure that's not heartburn. That might not be love. That may be indigestion. Actually, I've tried that a couple of times from a minister, it's been helpful. Anyway, to train our minds and our hearts, and when I use minds, and in Buddhism, when we use mind, we mean heart as well. There's no duality. The character for heart and mind is exactly the same in the calligraphy. The cave of the heart is the center of the mind, is the center of our disposition, is the center of our afflictions and our joy and our happiness and our gifts, etc. And so to train ourselves to be able to have our feelings come and let our feelings go without beating ourselves up for having the feeling we're having and without beating anybody else up for having the feeling we're having. We have a lot of difficulty with that in this society. And it's increasing. It really is. More and more cases on a daily basis. We see this at our hospital. And we have more than one location, but in our healthcare system, more and more people are being hurt by other people because they hurt their feelings. And we haven't been trained on how to handle our feelings. I heard a guy say, well, I shot him because he scared me. So, I won't say where that person is from, but I never intend to live anywhere near him. Mm-hmm. And he was proud. Mm-hmm. He was full of pride that he shot this person for scaring him. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, this, I'm trying to say, this has social implications. This has to do with the character of our society. The character of our capacity to be together, to be community. To embody respect, patience, and listening. And I don't mean there aren't scary people. I've met some. And so have you. But I haven't need to shoot him. And I could. Never occurred to me that was the action necessary. Actually, I walked up to one and said, what the hell do you think you're doing? But my grandmother got in for a second. The first he was so surprised he just handed me his gun. Who knew? So to practice being able to be present for the rising and falling of pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings. And for a practitioner of mindfulness, every neutral feeling can be turned into a positive feeling. This is the whole idea of gratitude practice. When you look back at your day, what we were doing in the prayer exercise, and that Joyce let us in, we look back at that day, and all of a sudden, gratitude, all the things we were just neutral. We didn't think of it much. It wasn't positive, it wasn't negative, but it happened. And a practitioner can turn every neutral experience into a positive one by just putting your awareness on it, and then gratitude starts to occur. Right, you're getting nourished by gratitude of how life cares for you, how life supports you. So the training of mindfulness here is to learn to abide peacefully or with equanimity in the midst of the rising and falling of our feelings. Again, and a lot of people have misinterpreted Buddhism again to think Buddhists suppress feelings. expressing their feelings as their business, but it's got nothing to do with being Buddhist. Everybody's welcome to suppress their feelings. But the practice is not to suppress their feelings. The practice is to have the courage to be present for your feelings with non-aversion and non-greed.
Non-what?
Greed.
Greed.
Meaning, you want to build a monument to that feeling. Or you want to keep that feeling forever. Or that's the only feeling you want to have the rest of your life. And so all other feelings, all other circumstances that might create different feelings, all other relationships that might engage in different feelings get pushed aside. That's grief. This is deep practice. Feelings. Peggy and I, when we did consulting in corporations, this is a phrase from Peggy, but we discovered that the F word in corporations was feelings. And for men, and I can say this since I am one, out of the 4,000 or so feelings that are so far documented in the human experience, we tend to cling to two. We have permission to get really pissed off or really excited. And not much else. And there are consequences. This is my doctor who I was getting my annual physical check. I do anyway, but it's a part of my job responsibility, so everyone gets an annual health checkup. As my doctor said, you know, you men, you don't live as long as women. One of the reasons is you don't handle feelings so well. I said, yeah, I know that. But I'm working on it. I'm working. I think I now can cry every day at least once. Something moves me. This is a result of the practice. I'm not talking about some personal achievement here. The result of the practice has meant I get touched every day. It can be as simple as a hummingbird outside the window. It can be as simple as the way the light strikes the flowers outside. It can be as simple as seeing a family coming into the emergency room full of fear and anxiety with their loved one. It can be as simple as walking down to see how our doctors or nurses are dealing with the impact of a child that just passed away, a baby that just passed away. It can be small and large. One of the insights of mindfulness practice is the infinitesimally large is inside the infinitesimally small. So our little dog, Charlie, has the whole cosmos in his little eyes, in his little walk. Feelings. The practice of equanimity. And in the teachings given to the sick, which is another sutra in Buddhism, I was practicing 10 years before I realized I was sick. I thought it was for people who were about to pass over. Until I realized, I'm about to pass over. On a regular basis. And so I was sick, and so I needed that teaching. This wasn't just a hospice moment. And the teaching is, this body is not me. I am not caught in this body. This feeling is not me. I am not caught. I am not defined by this feeling. It's an experience, but it's not a definition of who And because I want to, so the feeling, the magic show of feelings, get accustomed to being with, enjoying, participating in, and observing the magic show of feelings. And just think about it, and observe yourself in the course of the day and see how many different feelings you have. It's amazing how we change, how the river of feelings, I like to use the image of a river of feelings flowing, and then there's the tributaries entering in. And noticing the conditions outside of you that create this sense of feelings, noticing the conditions inside of you that contribute to your experience of feelings. But remember, feelings are fleeting. It doesn't mean they don't come around again, but if they do, they're also fleeting. So the other two foundations of mindfulness, I'm not going to go into, because I want to go to my conclusion in terms of our time, and then that gives me an excuse for coming back. So, why does any of this matter? This, you know, I have questions from people, particularly in theological schools and seminaries, or in social action events and groups where I'm with social people focused on social work or community development. Why does any of this contemplative meditative stuff matter? Well, first of all, it matters because all action is social action. There's not something that's not social action. There's not some action that does not contribute to the definition of, the meaning of, the patterns of, and the value of society. How we shop is social action. What we use when we garden is social action. Who we bank with is social action. How we spend our money is social action. Who we talk to, who we don't talk to, are all social action. There is no escape from social action. For me, and I've learned this through contemplative practice, the question is the quality of my action. Is my action insightful? Is it touched with wisdom? Wisdom beyond reactivity. Our native traditions in the U.S. like to remind us that wisdom in action means that you have considered the impact of your action on the next 7 generations. And our economic system, which defines our whole society, is based on quarters. Every 3 months, we have a redefinition of success. Well, how in the world, the whole thing that happened with our economics would have never even been able to occur if we had had the wisdom of 7 generations of our actions. Our ecological situation. You know, I actually hear people say, well, I'll be dead, so what do I care? It's my grandkids' problem. Well, I don't have any kids, so I don't even have that problem to worry about. How self-centered is this? How disconnected from the body is this? And the quality of our action, the question is it bending, to use an image from Martin Luther King, is it bending toward the arc of justice is our action? Is it bending toward the arc of wholeness? Is it bending toward the arc of awakening us? As Stephen Fry reminded us in his poem, In the Sleep of Pit. Does our action go in that direction? Contribute to the momentum in that direction. There are fabulous things going on all over this world, and I like to tell people who've not had the luxury I've had of living and working in many, many countries and many, many cultures and many, many environments, that most of the people I've met in the world absolutely fabulous. 98% of them are absolutely remarkable, wonderful, caring people. It's that 2% should either be in therapy or in jail. And the 2% get all the coverage. This is another example of not understanding how to benefit from what's neutral. So there's no coverage unless something horrible happens. No attention is drawn to us being here this weekend. There are thousands of groups in various forms this weekend all over this planet praying for peace, praying for a transformation of poverty, praying for a new way to relate to our planet. And we will hear none of it. It will have not be reflected back to us in our system. And so some of us have got to go into media, because what we have now is insane. It's more than dysfunctional. It is dysfunctional and loving it. That's insanity. And it's creating suffering. Day in and day out. And it's creating suffering because it's creating ignorance about the true nature of things. So our engagement is best understood in, for me now, in the language of Thomas Berry, as the great work. All of us are in the great work. Whatever our profession may be, we are engaged in the great work of healing and transforming and really creating a planetary sensibility, a planetary identity, a planetary ethic. And because this is the opportunity, this is the work, a fundamental re-understanding of what it means to be human is what we're confronted with. We cannot get there from the old understanding of being human. And so for me, contemplative practice, deep contemplative practice, is a methodology through which we can transform our old understandings and old attachments and old definitions of being human and open up new space to create a new understanding of who and what we are. That works on us as individuals and it can work on us as a collective. In the order, we used to say that a new social vehicle requires a new religious mode. That's not just an idea. That's a fact. And if you don't believe me, study history. We didn't just make that up. Now, we didn't get everything right, as you know. But some things we absolutely got right, and we need to know it. When we analyzed what the fundamental crisis of the future was going to be, we said it had something to do with the Middle East. We said that 50 years ago. When we looked at the social process and we said there's an imbalance in the social process, the economic has become dominant of the entire social process, the political process is collapsed, which to me means you have to consider it theater, bad theater. And the cultural process is disempowering. And that if we want to rebalance society, we have to re-empower the cultural process, redefine meaning. And at the top of that, you know what we said it was inclusive mythology. A story about being human that can include all of us. Whether we are Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Buddhist, inclusive mythology. And then Joseph Campbell had the insight that the inclusive mythology we're looking for is not prose, it's experiential. It's the experience of our shared humanness. And for me, contemplative practice is a vehicle and a method through which we can experience our profound humanness. It is not about, as somebody asked me at OCU, is this about creating a new religion? No, this is about transparentizing religious experience so that we are able to come to the common ground of our own humanness. And from the common ground of our own humanness, we can protect ourselves against the craziness of our own religions. We'll protect ourselves against the craziness of our own governments, our own nationalisms, our own whatever it is that you want to. But that has to do with our profound sense of being human. I actually had somebody ask me recently, which I thought was kind of funny, was I a Buddhist? I said, I'm a human being. When somebody asked me recently, was I a Democrat? I said, well, I'm a human being. We've got to get that right, or we'll never get out of this mess. Sure, you can be a Democrat. Sure, you can be a Buddhist. But those are all one of my favorite stories that just occurred to me. It happened in 1977, and I just remembered it last weekend. Boy, oh boy. And so at my first visit to India, where I was in Calcutta, and we were on our way to some villages on the train, of course, third class, where we always traveled. And so I'm with P.T. James, my partner there in India, and his wife, Himawanta. And, you know, I'm saying, I'm hungry. You know, there's people on, they're trained in India, they serve food, and I'm saying, well, we'll be at a little train restaurant soon. So we pull in after riding 3 or 4 hours. You know, it's a fabulous experience. Every time I could take the train, except for that possible ride, I was always very excited to look at the countryside and see people and breathe in and breathe out the vastness and beauty of India. But anyway, we pull up in front of the restaurant, and it's like made like an old Western saloon. On this side, there's two doors that swing, and on this side, there's two doors that swing. And over the top of this door, it said vegetarian. And over the top of this door, it said non-vegetarian. So I decided I was going to do non-vegetarian, and PT decided he was going to do non-vegetarian. But Himalata, his wife, decided she was going to do vegetarian. So we separated, and we went in, and we ended up in exactly the same place. We must understand this. This is our place of our fundamental confusion. In the Yogacara tradition of Buddhism, this is referred to as imaginary truth, constructed truth, necessary, but imaginary. Buddhist door, Christian door, Democrat door, Republican door. You can see we're in the same mess. It didn't matter which door you went through. We must understand the, as Emma said yesterday, the limiting nature of our language and how easily it can confuse us about what is real. And it is our profound humanness that is real. And all of our vehicles and tools and resources, our vehicles, tools, and resources to help nourish that, develop that profound humanity. The challenge, as I see it, is evolutionary maturity. Helping all of us become mature enough to manifest this next stage of evolution. That's why I've really been enjoying the Larry Chimpanzee book. And I must admit, I have found it extremely enjoyable to observe everyone as if they were a chimpanzee. Starting with myself. It starts off my day in laughter. I don't take myself too seriously after that visualization, which isn't hard to do. And then I start to see people as I go through the hospital. I'm like, God, we are. We're sophisticated. We drive. We brush our teeth with Crest and other kinds of gadgets. But our conditioning for survival, our capacity to do harm, is ancient, rooted in our biology, in our instinct for survival. And part of this is about coming home to who we are. And part of what we have to do is learn to work with and transform these drivers. In the book, The Third Chimpanzee, one of the things he points out is there is no species who comes remotely close to the capacity for damaging its own species than human. And he lists genocide. Nothing comes close. No, we put up on the website, say, here's the most dangerous creature on earth, there's a lion, and here's a blah, blah, blah. You need to put a baby up there, a human being up there. Nothing comes close to our destructive capacity. And now that we have a nuclear weapon, this is urgent. I know yesterday I said 100 million years some galaxies are burning. That was yesterday. Today I'm telling you, we got to get on this right now. From the context of that, with the awareness of that, evolutionary maturity. Pema Chodron, who someone mentioned here, both in their writing and in a brief discussion, she said her mantra, her suggestion for a mantra for the Western world is Om, grow up, swaha. Om, grow up, swaha. Growing up. It's time to grow up. It's time to grow up. And you can actually look at some of our behaviors and look back into anthropology of chimpanzees and see the model of that behavior. Actually, there was a politician not long ago who went into a tirade over immigration. And literally, he was just beside himself. 3 days later, someone found on the internet a chimpanzee having a tirade. And their gestures were exactly the same. That was Pat Buchanan. And you can YouTube this, okay? So I'm not trying to pick on Pat.
What worse?
No, what I'm trying to say is, when I see that now, I realize what I'm thinking. This is a chimp having a bad day. And needs help, needs education, needs the development of evolutionary maturity, which to me will only come through spiritual practice. This is not an intellectual exercise, because Karl Rove is very well read. It's not his intellect that's the problem. It's his depth consciousness that uses that intellect, that drives that intellect, that interprets what that intellect runs into, that's dangerous. And that's true about all of us. I'm not trying to pick on Carl. The same thing is true about Rara. And so, in the Buddhist tradition, though it doesn't have anything to do with being Buddhist, there's a term of what's called the Great Vow. When we practice contemplative life, when we practice mindfulness, we get to the point where our compassion grows. Because we start to see how suffering is created in our world. We start to see how nobody really wants to have suffering. And they do their best to try not to have suffering, and often that creates more suffering. And so our compassion grows, and we take what is called the great vow. And the great vow has two pieces. The first one is to heal and transform your own suffering. And B is so that you can devote your life to healing and transforming the suffering of every other being. And C is you commit to do this forever. The most moving story I've heard in the last week surprised me. It came from a story about a young woman who was working with women in Afghanistan, helping to build schools. You may have heard this story, which was kind of an anniversary event. And she was caught by the Taliban helping to build, to get women into school, and burned alive. She was a young woman, 24, 25 years old. She's a bodhisattva. It's got nothing to do with being Buddhist. It has to do with your action and the quality of your heart and of your mind. And just recently, she wrote, her mother, there was an interview with her mother, and she wrote a letter to her family on what to do in case something bad happened to her. And she had been to Afghanistan before, but she wrote this like 2 weeks before she went for her last trip. And in it, she said, if something happens to me, I want you to create a foundation to help the women of Afghanistan get educated, because as I see it, that is the structural solution to the underlying contradiction. She went to Wellesley, East Coast, to that women's college. That women's college now has a program dedicated to Afghan women going to college. And I got to hear an interview with one of their first graduates, an Afghan woman, whose sole commitment is to make sure other Afghan women get the opportunity that she's had. That's the great vow. And there's tremendous numbers of people embodying this vow all over this planet. What we have to figure out how to do is to recognize one another. Taking our not unaware that we're sitting in a room of bodhisattvas here. Wise beings. Compassion. Wisdom. And action in the world here. We're not unaware of who we're with this weekend. But we want you to know every weekend we find more and more. In every place we go, we run into such qualities. We need our own publication system. We need our own TV network. We need our own radio shows. The work that came out of this group last night, somebody should take it and publish it. It was just remarkable. The writings, the poetries. And the point here isn't to become famous. The point here is to nourish this vow in all of us so the flame of it never goes out. It isn't that we fix the world. It is that we demonstrate how to live in this world. So even if you believe in the Hindu idea that you may come around again, please remember, you just be picking up where you left off. And so you have job security. Bodhisattvas always have job security. One of the greatest stories from the Lotus Sutra about a bodhisattva I mentioned in conclusion, his or her name was Medicine King. And this was a wise being who was a practitioner of contemplation, and was devoted to the practice, devoted to his teacher, devoted to his community. And when he died, he just thought he died, and then he woke up again, he was on fire, lighting up the whole countryside. And his fire went on for 1,200 years until everybody got the message. The last time I was in Atlanta, not Memphis, during my religious group, they and I were at the Vietnamese monastery in Memphis. And we had just come from walking, which I always do when I go to Memphis, where Martin was shot and killed in the museum, et cetera, et cetera. And one of our hosts there, a fine black man, a veteran, damaged in Vietnam, wanted to know how we would deal with the loss of Martin. He was still grieving. And I said, well, I don't know, but my experience is Martin Luther King is more powerful than ever. Bigger than ever. More influential than ever. Don't believe me? Go to India, walk into a village, and you'll find there's a bust of Martin Luther King. Go to places in Africa, go to Russia, go to China, and you'll find people moved. Peggy and I were in Beijing some years ago, and we were at an orphanage. I'll come to the end of the story. I won't go through the other part, which is really sweet. But this was an orphanage of young men and women, and who were being taught meditation and Tai Chi and Chinese medicine, etc. And when we were getting ready to leave, they invited us outside because someone, not me, mentioned to these somebody in this group that I was also an orphan. I was found on the streets of Cleveland, Ohio, and was in a hospital until I was 8 months old before I was adopted by fabulous people. And so we were getting ready to leave, and we walk out, and hear all the children. And they sang, "We Shall Overcome." Without a songbook, without direction. So understand that as a bodhisattva, you have a limitless life. And that's nothing special, because Hitler also has a limitless life. There are people still studying Mein Kampf. That's all right. The question is, what are you and I doing with our life? What are we writing? What are we thinking? What are we speaking? What are we doing with our bodies to enable this shift? And we're close. We're really close. That's why there's so much chaos. Because we're so close. If we weren't close, demons would be dancing in our face. Understand the mythic journey. All the wrong comes up to greet you when you're close. Take good care.